In June 1980, issue of Covert Action Information Bulletin.
Yeah.
There's an article entitled Mind Control, the Story of Mankind Research.
Yes.
You know this?
Yes.
In which Weberman states that Christopher Byrd worked for the CIA and specialized in psychological warfare.
Uh-huh.
And Peter Tompkins is an OSS, ex-OSS agent.
Uh-huh.
Are the books authored by Byrd and Tompkins, Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain, and The Secret Life with Plants, some kind of a CIA disinformation?
Well, that's an interesting question, because it's almost like the when you look at, again, the meta view of this kind of thing, including the alien phenomena, alien abduction phenomena, you find out that for every yes, there's a no. You know, for every guy that says, I have the J.B. Rhine's research in Duke University in the 50s was CIA funded. And it got positive results. I would bet it's 50, I would bet it was 65% positive telepathic results. The average man, 65% of the time. Telepathy, reliable telepathic results can be induced in an average man 65% of the time. Well, do you know that information? Have you seen that information? It's covered up. You know, they debunked, they said, oh, we wasted all this money on Duke University. CIA funded the research, right? And there are a whole lot of people that are victims of mind control that were hypnoprogram presidential models that were recruited from the Duke University parapsychology experiments. They were volunteers for parapsychology. And then they ended up being sex slaves and couriers and drug mules working under, you know, with these. Now, 30 years later, they're remembering. So for every yes, there's a no. I was taken by a man in England named David Bearglass. I was on the BBC. And he says, gosh, Dr. Sargent is talking. I mean, you've got to come to the Royal Academy with us to hear this. And I thought it was William Sargent, the guy that wrote The Battle for Men's Minds. But it was another guy, a younger guy at Cambridge who was doing a telepathy experiment in which white sound was put into the ears of the receiver and ping pong balls that were stimulated like a blind person, just white light. And it's the same thing as a peyote ceremony. The drum and the fire keeps your senses occupied. And in the other room, in the other building, are random 50 envelopes with torn out photos from Life magazine or something. And you open one of them, you're the sender. And you've all been tested. With the cards, you show no measurable ability of the ESP. Neither the sender nor the receiver. And you go into this room, and you're the sender, and you open the thing, and you get a picture of a ship or something. All right, and then you concentrate on the picture of the ship. 65% of the time, the guy that's the receiver with the ping-pong balls on his eyes and the white sound in his ears will draw a picture of a ship or whatever it is you're sending. There's a match 65% of the time. I saw this paper presented, and I was taken there by this man named David Bearglass, who is a mentalist. He's an expert in micro-muscle movement reading, and it's an uncanny ability that I guess we all can learn. It's like heightened sensory acuity. You know, and NLP teaches you some, neuro-linguistics programming teaches you some of these things. But this guy had it developed to an nth degree. He was like the amazing Randy, you know, who's the CIA version of David Bearglass. So Bearglass kept us out till 4 in the morning, and we had a great time having dinner. Omni Magazine was the host of this affair, and I got to talk a lot with Sargent, and I was really impressed with what he was doing. And on the way home, this guy, Bearglass guy, kept getting up to make a phone call, and I said, where are you going, Dave? He says, my 40th wedding anniversary, I have to call my wife. And finally we go home, and he's taking me back to the hotel in his big Pontiac American car in these narrow British streets, and it suddenly registers, this is something weird. So we got to the hotel, and I said, David, how long have you been working for MI6? He said, oh, about 20 years, you know. So, and he was the debunker of Sargent. And I went with this guy and heard this great presentation about telepathy. Then this Bear Glass guy and two other guys get up and they just rake this guy over the coal. They were nasty and venomous and called him a fraud. It's doctor. And then everybody's polite afterwards, and it's very strange. So for every yes, there's a no. And it's almost like with the UFO phenomenon. Can you handle it? What if we are in contact with an alien culture? All right, that's millions of years more advanced. Goodbye, religion. We're not going to believe in science anymore, not the science we've got. We're not going to believe in our government anymore. Because they don't know anything.
Another Hypno Patsy. On April 4th, 1968, Nobel laureate Dr. Martin Luther King was murdered on a second-floor balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. Half of the 6,000-man FBI force was assigned to be a task of bringing the killer to justice. The FBI should have had an easy job. There was an abundance of evidence left behind on the second floor of a rooming house a block from the Lorraine Motel. There were fingerprints on the window ledge of a bathroom next to a room which had been rented to Eric S. Galt. On the sidewalk in front of the house was a weapon, a high-powered assault rifle with telescopic sight. Neighbors said they had seen a white Mustang roar away moments after the shooting. Nevertheless, the killer got away. A ham radio reporter broadcasting from a fixed station posed as a CB operator in mobile unit. He broadcast a convincing account of a high-speed chase between a white Mustang and a blue Pontiac. He reported that the two cars were shooting at each other. While police concentrated their search in the area described by the ham operator, the white Mustang they were seeking sped away from Memphis in the other direction. The ham operator's actions were explained away by authorities as a hoax. Within a few days, local police and authorities showed up. While the use of the high-powered ham radio on the elevator meter CB band and the broadcasting of false emergency information are the two clear violations of the Federal Communications Code, the identity and fate of the ham prankster are not known. The FBI soon discovered the fingerprints left at the scene of the crime belonged to the man who rented the room, Eric S. Galt. Through a computer search, they later found Galt's real name was James Earl Ray. The day after Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated in Los Angeles, James Earl Ray was captured in London. He was apprehended by British customs inspectors while attempting to leave the country on a passport issued to a Canadian constable. Ray was quickly extradited to Tennessee for trial. The lengthy search and investigation, billed as the most complete manhunt in history, was followed by one of the shortest trials in history. On March 10, 1969, less than 1 year after the assassination, Ray had his day in court, literally. By most standards, he was not a trial, but a deal. The deal had been arranged by Ray's attorneys, who had urged him to plead guilty so he would not get 99 years instead of the death penalty. Under Tennessee law, even if a defendant enters a guilty plea, a jury is required to attend the plea and to ratify the plea and the sentence. In a courtroom sealed by the tightest possible security, 12 jurors heard Prosecutor Canal say he would, as required by law, outline the evidence which would have been presented had the case gone to formal trial. Canal then asked the jury if they could sit down as jurors and accept the guilty plea from the defendant. They nodded in unison. Canal told the jury, "There are rumors going around, perhaps some of you have heard them, that Mr. James Earl Ray was a dupe in this thing, or a fall guy, or a member of a conspiracy to kill Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I want to state to you, as your attorney general, we have no proof other than that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was killed by James Earl Ray, and James Earl Ray alone, not in court with anyone else. Our office examined over 5,000 printed pages of investigation work done by local police, by national police organizations, and by international law enforcement agencies. We have examined over 300 physical bits of evidence, physical exhibits, three men in my office, Mr. Dwyer, Mr. Beasley, and Mr. John Carlisle, the chief investigator of the Attorney General's office. having traveled thousands of miles all over this country and to many cities and foreign countries on this investigation, our own independent investigation, and I just state to you frankly, we have no evidence there is any conspiracy involved in any of this. The state had not charged Ray with conspiracy. It had charged him with murder in the first degree. Nevertheless, the prosecutor felt compelled to deny that Ray had collaborators. Though it was not presented at the trial, Ray's version of the story had already been published. In a series of magazine articles written by William Bradford Huey, Ray had confessed he had been the unwitting pawn in a conspiracy to kill Dr. King. Stranger still was the reaction of defense attorney Percy Foreman, a man who had never lost a case. To the remarks of the prosecuting attorney, as soon as Canal had finished issuing this disclaimer of the conspiracy, Foreman rose and faced the jury. "It's an honor to appear in this court for this case. I never expected or had any idea when I entered this case that I would be able to accomplish anything except perhaps save the defendant's life. It took me a month to convince myself of the fact which the Attorney General of these United States and J. Edgar Hoover of the Federal Bureau of Investigation announced last July. That is, what Mr. Canal had told you, that there was not a conspiracy." Just as the jury was about to rubber stamp, quote, the deal, Ray rose to his feet. "Your Honor," he said, "I would like to say something. I don't want to change anything I have said, but I just want to enter one thing. The only thing I have to say is that I can't agree with Mr. Clark." "Ramsey Clark?" Foreman asked. The judge said, "Mr. who?" "Mr. J. Edgar Hoover," Ray said. "I agree with all these stipulations and I am not trying to change anything." The judge said, "You don't agree with these theories?" "Mr. Canal, Mr. Clark, and Mr. J. Edgar Hoover about the conspiracy, I don't want to add something that I haven't agreed to in the past," Ray answered, making sure he did not blow the deal. Foreman tried to explain. "I think what he said is he doesn't agree that Ramsey Clark is right or that J. Edgar Hoover is right. I didn't argue that as evidence in this case. I simply stated, underwriting the statement of General Canal, that they had made that same statement. You are not required to agree with it at all." The judge wanted nothing to sidetrack the smooth proceedings. Your answers to the questions I asked you would still be the same. Is that correct?" "Yes, sir," Ray answered. And so the proceedings continued with Canal's presentation of a report of what had been the evidence that had made this a real trial. After hearing from eyewitnesses that Dr. King had been killed on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel, Canal called experts from the Memphis Police Department and the FBI to testify on how they accumulated physical evidence linking Ray to the scene of the crime. In the boarding house from which Ray, aka Eric Starvo Galt, had rented, the FBI and police found a green bedspread, a pair of pliers and a hammer, some shaving articles, binoculars, beer cans, a newspaper, a t-shirt, shorts, a transistor radio, and two leather straps for binoculars. The testimony established that the white Mustang was found in Atlanta, Georgia. It had a sticker on it that indicated it had been obtained in Los Angeles, California, as had the t-shirt and shorts. In the bathroom from where the shot was supposed to have been fired, the investigator found scuff marks in the bottom of the tub. They found the window of the bathroom open and the screen forced off. This window still was ordered removed, was cut away, and was subsequently sent to the FBI for comparison, Canal said. And the proof would show that through expert testimony that the markings on the sill were consistent with the machine markings as reflected in the barrel of the 30-06 rifle, which here had hitherto been introduced to you. "If this were a trial," Canal said, "eyewitnesses would be called to testify that Ray had purchased the rifle in Birmingham, Alabama, and that he'd stayed at a motel in the city and had checked out on the 19th of December and had returned to Los Angeles. Also, Dr. Russell C. Hadley of Hollywood, California, would be called by the state to testify that in his capacity as plastic surgeon, he did perform an operation on the nose of the defendant under the name of Eric Galt on March 5, 1968. Canal placed in evidence a photo he said was of James Earl Ray, a photo of graduating class from the International School of Bartending. Other evidence Canal said would have been presented in the trial was the expert testimony of FBI fingerprint analyst George Bernanke. The fingerprint expert would testify that he found a print of sufficient clarity on the rifle, another print of sufficient clarity for identification of the scope mounted on the rifle, a print on the binoculars, a print on the front page of the April 4th issue of the Memphis Commercial Appeal, and prints of sufficient clarity on maps of Atlanta, Birmingham, Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Mexico, all of which, it could be proved, were the fingerprints of James Earl Ray. The entire presentation of the case took just under 3 hours. There was a recess for lunch, after which Ray was ordered jailed for 99 years. As soon as Ray began to serve his sentence, he renewed his protestations of innocence and began working for a new trial. He fired attorneys Percy Foreman and Arthur Haynes, alleging he had not had a fair trial. He said he'd been set up to take the rap for a crime he didn't commit. At Ray's hearing on a new trial, he stated under oath, "I personally did not shoot Dr. King, but I have been partly responsible without knowing it." If Ray's psychological profile made him a likely victim for anyone who might need a fall guy in a murder, he was equally well suited to be a victim of mind control. Crimes from which he had previously been tried and convicted were all robberies in which no one was harmed. They were all remarkable for one thing, the chase that followed. Each time Ray committed a crime, he left a trail of evidence. Each time he left the scene in either a foot trace or hair racing car chase, with outraged citizens or police both in hot pursuit. In each crime, Ray behaved like a little boy who just stolen money from his father's pockets and was then daring him to catch and punish him. He was from a depraved family, the eldest of 8 children. Many individuals who were once emotionally deprived children learned to seek negative attention since positive attention was unavailable to them in their formative years. James Earl Ray fit that pattern. In the opinion of psychologists, he may have committed his daring daylight robberies not out of need for money, but out of subconscious desire to receive love. The only evidence which cast light on Ray's possible motive for the assassination was an eyewitness report that he had spoken passionately on his hatred of blacks in Los Angeles bar. A few days after Ray's sentencing, other evidence came to light which suggests the FBI had a stronger motivation than James Earl Ray to kill Martin Luther King. On November 19, 1975, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence made public the fact that the FBI had sent a compromising tape recording with an anonymous letter to Dr. King in late 1964 in a crude attempt to blackmail him into silence. Dr. King had thought the tape and letter were an effort to drive him to suicide. King received the package 34 days before he was received the Nobel Peace Prize. The tape was allegedly of a sexual encounter of Dr. King and a young woman. It was accompanied by an unsigned note that read, "King, there is only one thing left for you to do. You know what it is. You have just 34 days in which to do it. This exact number has been selected for a specific reason. It has a definite practical significance. You're done. This is but one way out for you." A month after Dr. King received his copy of the tape, a duplicate was sent to his wife. Mrs. King said publicly she and her husband had listened to the tape together and had concluded that nothing on that would discredit King. The Senate subcommittee said that about the same time Mrs. King had received her copy of the tape, a copy was submitted to FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. Accompanying that tape was a memorandum written by the FBI Chief of Counterintelligence William Sullivan. The memo suggested the FBI discredit King by, quote, "knocking him off his pedestal." The Senate committee disclosed further that the FBI kept tabs on Dr. King for 6 years prior to his death. It had instituted 16 different wiretap operations and had planted 8 room bugs in attempts to catch him in some compromising situation which could be used for blackmail or public discreditation. The shocked Senate subcommittee members discovered the tapes and bugs had produced thousands of hours of tapes. In addition, it was discovered that Hoover had ordered some of his men to rewrite reports which had originally indicated King was not a threat to the country. Those officials who were ordered to change their reports readily did so, the committee said, because they feared for their jobs. After the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence made these facts known, Mrs. Coretta King said that she had been feared what she'd said before. She said that she believed her husband had been killed by a government conspiracy. The way he was documented and followed around by Hoover and CIA when he was abroad, his assassination would have to be attached to the forces of our government that felt he was a threat to the system as it existed, said Mrs. King. A few days after Mrs. King issued that statement, Maryland private investigator Harold Weisberg used the Freedom of Information Act to obtain previously classified FBI reports. These reports revealed that directly contrary to claims made by Connell at Ray's trial, the FBI had been unable to find any physical evidence that a rifle had been fired from the window in Ray's rooming house, either in the weapon or in the room from which the assassin had allegedly fired. This was a crucial discovery, in that it was the knife and the rifle alone which linked Ray to the killing. If the rifle was not fired from the second-story room, then no matter how Ray's fingerprints got on the weapon, reasonable doubt existed that Ray was the assassin. No ballistics evidence links the rifle to the bullets in King's body. The FBI's evidence, which was kept secret, had all the while pointed to the conclusion that the rifle could have been planted in front of the rooming house to implicate Ray while the real assassin had fired from the location outside the rooming house. A few months after Weinberg's find, Newsday published a copyrighted story reporting that a top law enforcement official in Memphis had removed one particular black detective who had been assigned to protect Dr. King just hours before he was assassinated. The Newsday article suggested that Detective Ed Reddit had been pulled from his post because he had developed a contingency plan to apprehend any assassin who might make an attempt on King's life. Reddit's plan was to seal off four-block area in the event a shot was fired. Earlier the same week, Newsday had revealed that the Memphis Police Department had assigned provocateurs to protect King. The paper charged that men who had previously participated in anti-King riots were protecting the civil rights leader at the moment he was shot. The activities of James Earl Ray during the years preceding the assassination could be interpreted to suggest the possibility that Ray was a patsy in the mold of Oswald. Ray had been in New Mexico, New Orleans, and Los Angeles, places which had figured prominently in the activities of Oswald and others were indicated by Jim Garrison. Facts were not presented at Ray's quick trial, including the following. Ray had escaped from prison 1 year before the King assassination. Evidence indicated that he had been helped by someone in his escape. During the year he was on the lam, he received an estimated $12,000 from a source he identified only as Raoul. He had no difficulty in obtaining a car, several complete sets of identification. Each set belonged to a living individual, something an intelligence agent would prefer if he were to set up a false identity. Ray had no difficulty traveling all over the United States, Canada, and Mexico with his fake papers. The contrary history of Ray's activities in Los Angeles led private investigators to consider, as they had the Oswald case, that there may have been two James Earl Rays. One, the James Earl Ray, who had been in prison, was a painfully shy fellow who seldom opened his mouth and hardly ever raised his voice. Fellow inmates found that they had a hard time describing him since he maintained such a low profile. He had been raised dirt poor, had never graduated from a school of any kind, and there was no record of his ever having expressed political ideas about anyone. In Los Angeles, the other James Earl Ray was described as an outgoing fellow. He enrolled in and graduated from a bartending school. He became involved in an altercation with a girl in a bar who objected to his making slurs about black people. He was very conscientious about his appearance and was an impeccable dresser, who even wore expensive alligator shoes, and he was a right-wing politician who conspicuously campaigned for George Wallace. On the other bit of evidence gives unity to the contradictions. Ray had been hypnotized while in Los Angeles. It was not mentioned in Ray's trial, but at the time of his arrest in London, he had been in possession of three books on hypnotism: Self-Hypnotism, The Technique and Its Use in Daily Living by Leslie McCron, How to Cash in on Your Hidden Memory Power by William Hersey, and Psychobernetics by Dr. Maxwell Maltz. Ray had written and been told at William Bladford Huey, I took a course in hypnosis while I was in L.A. I had a lot about it in prison and how it's used in dentistry and medicine. On November 27, 1967, Ray appeared at the office of Dr. Mark Freeman, a psychologist who practiced in Beverly Hills. Dr. Freeman remembered that Ray, who'd given his real name, asked to be hypnotized because he wanted to sleep better and remember things better. This fellow really wanted to improve his mind, Dr. Freeman said. He had an awe for learning. He had a bent for reading. He didn't fight hypnosis. He learned something. Dr. Freeman told George McMillan, author of The Making of an Assassin, you've got to keep in mind that I get a lot of angry people around here. A lot of people who come to me want to teach me how to do it. I get a lot of rough stuff around here. I mean, psychotic, that stuff. But I couldn't pick up of any of that with Ray. He made a favorable impression on me. He was a good pupil. I'd show him how to go under, and pretty soon he'd be lying on the couch on his back and start talking. I taught him eye fixation, bodily relaxation, how to open himself to suggestion. I gave him lots of positive feelings of confidence. It may have been that Freeman found Ray so suggestible that because he had been hypnotized before. His contact with Freeman and other hypnotists, he told Huey he'd been as many as 8, may have been prompted by an unconscious urge to undo what he had already been done to him. Hypnotically induced multiple personalities, one which was programmed to kill upon command, or merely one which programmed to run away, following his normal pattern, but this time on command. It's easy to program someone to do under post-hypnotic cue what he normally does, and it's a lot easier to program a patsy than it is to program a hitman. This strip of photos was circulated when James Earl Ray was a fugitive suspect in the King assassination. One employee of the psychiatrist who specializes in treating DID patients looked at the strip without knowing who it was and said, "This obviously must be a multiple personality patient."